Hey, I'm Brian Stelter, host of Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. This week, I'm talking with author Dave Cullen about the 25th anniversary of the Columbine Massacre.
Well, I think the anniversaries are a good time to just stop and take stock, because normally we're seeing things in isolation. And 10 years out, 20 years out, especially 25 years out, it's really good to step back and see, like, okay, what has this wrought?
Where are we now? What's changed? What hasn't? What should? Join me, Brian Stelter, on Inside the Hive from Vanity Fair. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
A warning for listeners. Throughout this podcast, we have original audio from various terrorist attacks, plus other recreations of them. We feel it's important to hear, but it can also be disturbing. In 1984, terrorists with the Irish Republican Army tried to assassinate British Prime Minister Margaret Thatcher. They failed, but they released a statement after that has become a truism in the world of security. You have to be lucky all the time. We only have to be lucky once. We forget now, but Al-Qaeda failed at as many attacks as it succeeded. It liked coordinated, multi-pronged, complex attacks, even if they didn't quite work at first. The group had succeeded at the complex task of near-simultaneous bombings at the U.S. embassies in Kenya and Tanzania in 1998. But it had mischosen the date, so the U.S. embassy in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania, was closed because of a national holiday. More than 200 people were killed in Nairobi, just 11 in Dar es Salaam, none of them American.
Very angry. It's inhuman, it's evil, it's despicable. This thing is completely alien to our history, alien to our political culture, and we will contain it.
The next year, in 1999, just before New Year's, Al-Qaeda had perhaps as many as a half dozen plots underway across the world. All of them were foiled. An alert customs agent stopped one Al-Qaeda operative trying to cross the U.S.-Canada border in Washington State, apparently on his way to bomb LAX. On the other side of the world, Jordanian intelligence intercepted a plot to attack multiple tourist attractions. And on January 3, 2000, Al-Qaeda tried to attack the Navy ship USS The Sullivans in Aden Harbor in Yemen, but they overloaded their explosive skiff and it sank. 10 months later, in October 2000, two suicide bombers, again in Aden Harbor, killed 17 sailors on the USS Cole.
We are working to identify the remains and to contact the next of kin of those individuals.
Even then, it didn't quite go according to plan. The man who was supposed to film the suicide bombing and record a massive propaganda victory, he overslept that morning. But even as FBI and NCIS agents picked through the wreckage of the Cole and Navy sailors wrestled to keep it afloat, an even bigger plot was already underway. I'm Garrett Graff, a journalist, historian, and author of the New York Times best-selling book, The Only Plane in the Sky, an oral history of 9/11. I've spent much of the last two decades studying and reporting on that tragedy and how it changed our world. But as we near the 20th anniversary of the attacks, it's clear that many people still don't understand what happened that day. From Long Lead and Goat Rodeo, this is Long Shadow, a podcast about the enduring mysteries and lingering questions of 9/11. Episode 4, How Air Traffic Controllers and Nervous Pilots in Sealed Cockpits May Have Stopped Another Wave of Attacks. Tuesday, September 11th, 2001, was Ben Sliney's first day on the job. He was the Federal Aviation Administration's new National Operations Manager. Here's Sliney on C-SPAN years later.
That's a position located in the Washington area that actually does not talk to any airplanes at all, but we have overarching authority over the nation's airspace, and that was my charge on that day. The safe and efficient operation of the nation's airspace.
That included tens of thousands of flights a day, all directed by a network of air traffic control centers spread across the country. But during the 8 a.m. hour, Sliney began to hear confusing reports of a hijacking unfolding in the Northeast.
I was about to go to a meeting at around just before 8:30, and the supervisor that I had designated to stand in my place during my absence caught me before I left the room and said that they're reporting a hijacking out of Boston. And I was surprised because I hadn't heard of a hijacking in years. I was familiar with them from years past, but my experience with hijackings, and indeed our protocol for hijackings, we cooperate. We get every other aircraft out of the hijacked aircraft's way and do everything we can to facilitate the route of flight that the pilot wants.
Then there was a report of a second hijacking. And as the minutes passed, it became clear that these were unlike any other hijackings that had ever occurred before. At 8:46 a.m., the first plane, American Airlines Flight 11, crashed. 17 minutes later, a second one, United Airlines Flight 175, crashed too. Traffic controllers were scrambling to figure out what was happening.
Cactus 193, can you guys see the city from behind you there?
It looks like the World Trade Center is on fire.
Yes, it's a Boeing 757, we think, just flew into the building.
Are you, you're not kidding, right?
No, I'm not kidding.
Oh, shit.
Around the same time, Frank Culberson was floating in space, hundreds of miles above the attacks. He was aboard the International Space Station, the only American not on planet Earth that day. Culberson first heard about the attacks from ground control as he orbited past the eastern seaboard.
I called the ground, and my flight surgeon, Steve Hart, came on, and I said, "Hey, Steve, how's it going?" He said, "Well, Frank, we're not having a very good day down here on Earth." And he began to describe to me what was happening in New York, the airplanes that were flown into the World Trade Center, the airplane that was flown into the Pentagon. And as we were talking, they said, "We just lost another airplane somewhere in Pennsylvania. We don't know where or what's happening." And they told us all they could, which wasn't very much. We didn't have live TV or live internet, so that was the only way for us to find out about that event. As we were talking, I looked at the laptop that has our world map on it, and I saw that we were coming across southern Canada, and in a minute we were going to be over New England. And so I raced around, and I said, "I'll be back to you in a minute," to the ground, and I raced around, found a video camera and a window facing in the right direction, which was in the Russian segment, and got in the window, and looking out the window from over Maine, about 400 miles away from New York City, I could clearly see the city. It was a perfect weather day all over the United States. And the only activity I could see was this big black column of smoke coming out of New York City, out over Long Island and over the Atlantic. And as I zoomed in with the video camera, I saw this big gray blob basically enveloping the southern part of Manhattan. And what I was seeing was a second tower come down. I didn't know exactly what I was seeing. I just assumed it was more explosions. I assumed tens of thousands of people were being hurt or killed. And it was just horrible to see my country under attack.
Back on the ground at FAA Command Center in Virginia, Ben Sliney watched the chaos unfold through televisions and radar scopes. United Airlines Flight 175 had just struck the South Tower of the World Trade Center.
That happened rather rapidly. United 175, I think, from the time he turned off his transponder and deviated until the time he impacted was only about 11 or 12 minutes. In fact, all four impacts occur within 75 minutes or so, and all four were airborne before the first one struck the North Tower.
So at 9:42, still in what were basically his first 2 hours on the job, Sliney gave an order no one has ever given, before or since. Land everything now. Regardless of their destination or whether the airport was ready, every commercial aircraft over the United States or en route to the country was to be forced down at the nearest airport. Sliney wondered whether he even had the legal power to give such an order, but across the nation, air traffic controllers quickly implemented it. September 11th was such a terrible, tragic day that it's hard to even consider the possibility that it could have been worse. When we talk about September 11th, we usually skip right over the incredible work of air traffic control that day. We forget about the focus and determination it took to land thousands of planes under incredible stress with no handbook.
That was unprecedented in American history for the nation to shut down their air traffic control system and to put 4,556 planes at places where they weren't accustomed to be for the most part and disrupt that whole aviation system. So my hat is off to all of those communities for their very flawless execution of a bad situation on that day.
The Herculean work of air traffic controllers that day meant that all but the four hijacked planes landed safely. But we only know that fact now. That morning, as the chaos unfolded, controllers remained worried that more flights had been hijacked. A Korean Air flight coming over the Pacific accidentally signaled an emergency hijacking code. Others went out of radio contact. And then there was Delta 1989, a flight a few minutes ahead of United Airlines Flight 93 that fit the profile of the other hijacked flights. Transcontinental, Boston to LAX. It appeared to be acting suspicious, in and out of radio contact, and initially air traffic controllers were confused, thinking that a reference that they heard to a bomb came from the Delta flight, not Flight 93. They feared Delta 1989 was hijacked. Air traffic controllers ordered it to land, and the military scrambled fighter jets from Ohio and Michigan to intercept it. An air traffic controller contacted the plane using the special code words to identify whether the pilots were acting under duress. The co-pilot, puzzled and suddenly scared, replied, "Not unless you know something we don't." The plane landed in Cleveland uneventfully around 10:30 that morning. It was met by an FBI SWAT team who held the plane and passengers for hours. On a normal day, these malfunctions happen all the time, a routine part of civil aviation. But September 11th was no ordinary day, and every deviation set off alarms. Everyone believed there were still more missiles in the sky. Skyscrapers were evacuated coast to coast. Office workers panicked in cities like Boston, Chicago, Los Angeles. Everyone, air traffic controllers, federal officials, and the public watching at home wanted to know one thing. Were more attacks coming? Were more planes going to be hijacked?
It's too early to say whether the terrorists gained access to the planes today because of poor security checks, but this much is clear. The hijackings were well planned, and the terrorists highly trained. Once on board, they knew exactly what to do.
When United Airlines pilot Tom Minello arrived home on the evening of September 11th, he finally understood the full scope of the attacks. That morning, he'd been supposed to captain a direct flight from JFK International in New York to LAX. But his plane never took off. The flight was canceled when New York Airport shut down in the minutes after the second attack.
And then, like pretty much everybody in America, I started watching TV.
This has been one of the darkest days in America, and it is not yet over. Here at home now, a quick look at the locations where the four airliners hit.
I saw the video of the first airplane hitting the trade centers and listened to the announcer say, okay, this was such and such a flight. It was a large airplane. It was filled with fuel on what we refer to as a transcon flight. It was obviously hijacked and used as a weapon of mass destruction.
Once aboard, many speculate the hijackers must have disabled crews and taken over the plane's controls. More likely that than forcing a pilot with a gun.
That's when it was just what I had a feeling was going on. That's when I said, oh my God, I was the next guy.
Had Tom Minello's plane, United Airlines Flight 23, narrowly escaped a hijacking? We know that there were four hijacked planes on 9/11, two flown into the World Trade Center, a third crashed into the Pentagon, and a fourth that slammed into the Pennsylvania countryside. But what if terrorists boarded other flights that morning? What if there was supposed to be a fifth plane on 9/11? To understand why we're even talking about this, you need to know a bit about Islamic extremism and the terrorist group called Al-Qaeda. Their hallmark was their persistence. After all, Islamic extremists had first tried to attack the World Trade Center nearly a decade earlier on a soggy winter day. It was in February 1993 when a pair of terrorists drove a yellow rental van into the parking garage beneath the North Tower. Their ringleader, Ramzi Youssef, hoped the 1,300-pound bomb in the back would destroy the foundation of the North Tower and topple it over into the other, killing everyone inside. Ramzi Youssef and his co-conspirator hopped out of the van, got into another getaway car, and drove away. Ultimately, the handmade bomb didn't destroy the building or its occupants. But it did kill six people who happened to be in the parking complex that day. It also injured more than 1,000 others, most from smoke inhalation.
The doors automatically locked on all the floors, so you couldn't get out of the staircase. So it was kind of shoulder to shoulder in the dark for over an hour.
That day, years before 9/11, 50,000 people successfully evacuated the World Trade Center's twin towers through the long staircases. The bomber Ramzi Youssef was not a member of Al-Qaeda, but his uncle, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, also known as KSM, would later become one of the group's top operational planners. Investigators and prosecutors have since called KSM the mastermind behind 9/11. This family alliance, Ramzi Youssef and KSM, became the bridge between an amorphous movement of Islamic extremists. They were angry at the U.S. support of Israel and troops stationed in the Holy Lands of the Middle East. That alliance later solidified into the umbrella of Al-Qaeda under the leadership of Osama bin Laden. Ultimately, they all had the same target, the iconic Twin Towers of the World Trade Center. A co-conspirator wrote that they had wanted to blow up the tourist attractions that Americans are so proud of. Ramzi Youssef had fled the U.S. right after the bombing and avoided the FBI, who quickly traced the rental van's VIN number. They arrested some of the other terrorists after one, amazingly, tried to get his security deposit back from the rental company. It's somewhere in this time frame that investigators later came to believe Ramzi Youssef reconnected with his uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, and through him to Osama bin Laden. The three started planning another attack and let their imaginations run wild. According to various government reports, it was a complicated plot. The scheme involved blowing up as many as 12 airliners over the Pacific, crashing planes into targets like the FBI headquarters and the CIA building in Langley, Virginia, bombs at U.S. and Israeli embassies, and even assassinating the Pope. And Osama bin Laden was behind it all. The plot was set for the following year.
And from there, the idea and the plan that ended up being 9/11 really evolved.
FBI Special Agent Jackie McGuire would go on to be one of the lead investigators after the September 11th attacks in the years after 2001.
You know, looking back and through investigation, through interviews, it seemed like there was certainly a desire to have this grand, you know, hijacking operation.
Ramzi Youssef successfully detonated a test bomb in December 1994 aboard a Philippines airline flight to Tokyo, killing one passenger. A month later, Pakistani and U.S. intelligence finally arrested him in Islamabad before he could execute the plot. When they rifled through his belongings, they found bomb parts hidden inside children's toys. But perhaps most ominously, Ramzi Youssef also had flight schedules for Delta and United Airlines. His uncle Khalid Sheikh Mohammed escaped the authorities and rejoined Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and the group picked up right where Youssef left off. According to the 9/11 Commission, Al-Qaeda's original idea for September 11th was to hijack as many as 10 planes. Terrorists would crash 9 of them into targets like the World Trade Center, the Capitol, and nuclear power plants. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed himself would pilot the 10th airliner. He would kill all the male passengers, land the plane, and make a statement before cameras denouncing the United States. Then he would release all the women and children aboard. But the 9/11 Commission found that Al-Qaeda couldn't recruit enough hijackers. Some were turned away even before they made it to the United States. So the terrorists seemed to scale down their plans. And so on the morning of September 11th, 19 hijackers boarded the four transcontinental airliners.
The terrorists used hijacked civilian airliners and their passengers as guided missiles in their attack. The most serious attack on this country.
And while we now know there were just the four attacks, that Tuesday night, much of the nation still wondered whether more terrorists were out there. Was there a second wave of attacks still coming? At home, watching TV, pilot Tom Minello kept stewing over this thought. Was his plane also supposed to be hijacked? It's a thought that even 20 years later has never left him.
It's a difficult question. On the anniversary, the first few anniversaries of it, I probably didn't sleep really good those nights.
Minello was active duty Air Force before he started flying commercial airliners. During our interview, he stopped several times to look at the extensive notes he took from the day of the attacks, notes he later shared when he talked with the FBI. Like three of the other four hijacked flights, his was a Boeing airliner headed for LAX. The passengers and crew boarded as the pilots prepared for takeoff.
I think I had my notes here, and it was pretty much right on time. We had no mechanical problems.
But as Flight 23 taxied out of the terminal, Minello and his co-pilot, Carol Timmons, heard the first reports of the attacks unfolding elsewhere in New York City.
We have some problems over here right now. We might have a hijack over here, two of them.
As I taxied out and came around, basically like around a corner around the terminals, the second inkling of something was wrong was I saw almost a dozen airplanes stopped. And at Kennedy at 9 o'clock in the morning, that was to see that many airplanes was very unusual. And we were informed that there was a ground stop, that nobody was going to be taking off or nobody was going to be landing. There was no explanation for that. Obviously, there was something going on, and Carol and I were talking about it. And that's when somebody on that frequency came out with the statement that an airplane had crashed into their World Trade Centers.
Now, stuck behind a line of other planes on the JFK tarmac, Minello's mind started racing. At first, he had the same innocent thought so many Americans had that morning. How could the plane strike the Twin Towers on such a clear day?
I had made an announcement over the PA that there had been an accident, there had been a crash into the World Trade Centers. And a lot of people requested the flight attendants allow them to use their cell phones, which was against the rules, but I had a feeling we weren't going anywhere for a long, long time, and it would not create a problem. So I made an announcement letting people use their cell phones.
Then they got a message in the cockpit
that said, "We have gone to heightened security. You are not to allow anyone into the cockpit under any circumstances."
Minello and Timmons were confused. They had been trained on how to deal with hijackings before. If someone tried to enter the cockpit, there were protocols. Calmly try to talk the attackers down. And if the hijackers had demands for the pilots, they should cooperate. Air traffic controllers would clear their path and try to land the plane as soon as possible. After all, before 9/11, no hijacker had ever seized a plane's controls himself. But whatever the pilots were being warned about today seemed different. Then, a flight attendant in the plane's cabin called the cockpit. Timmons was a decorated pilot herself from the Delaware Air National Guard, who would later become its first female general. Timmons, who died in 2020, also told this story to a local news outlet.
In the meantime, as we're taxiing back, flight attendant says, "Hey, I've got some very agitated men sitting in first class. They're very unhappy. Why aren't we taking off? Why aren't we taking off?"
There were apparently Arab or Middle Eastern looking men in first class, and they were frantic.
and said, well, look, I don't know what's going on here, but there's something unusual in my passengers here. I didn't want to believe that just because these gentlemen were there, that in fact they were getting ready to attack the airplane. It was just confusing, to be honest with you. I had told her of the message I had gotten from the company and explained to her that neither they nor any passenger, these four included, were coming up to the cockpit. Carol and I realized that at that point, we had to defend the cockpit.
Manello and Timmons didn't know what was going on in first class, but they started looking for anything that could be used as a weapon.
We have in the cockpit a crash axe. We have a fire extinguisher, both of which we discuss using as weapons if need be. Carol had a clever idea where there was a metal bulkhead where we stored our suitcases, and she found a way of wedging our suitcases between that metal partition, basically, and the cockpit door. So you would have had to literally break the door apart to get through.
As the two prepared for an attack on the cockpit, air traffic controllers came back over their radio.
Trying to remember if the most infamous radio call I could ever remember happened. Basically, the ground controllers had kept us advised about the ground stop and that nothing new was occurring. And after kind of a pause for a while, the ground controllers came on, and this is the radio call I'm going to speak of. I'll never forget. They said, let's see, what was the exact wording? Ladies and gentlemen, this airport is officially closed. We have been ordered to evacuate this facility. You're on your own.
The pilots pulled Flight 23 into a gate, and during the minutes-long shutdown process of the Boeing 767, the crew opened the doors and let the passengers off the plane. Timmons later told a local news outlet that the anxious men in first class vanished into the sea of people fleeing the airport. She and Manello stayed in their sealed cockpit, still prepared to fight off any potential attackers as the plane's engines shut down. Eventually, they exited the plane and entered an empty terminal. Later, when Manello saw the full scope of the attacks on the news, he spoke to his flight manager.
Explained to him the situation I had just seen. He he turned pale, brought me into the chief pilot's office. They called the FBI. And they said that they'll be in contact with me. I spent a good 2 to 3 hours the next morning talking to the agent. I still have his card. He was a local FBI agent and came and talked to me. I was trying to give him as much information, anything about the situation, the timing of where I was, that might lead them to discern any information about the four people I had on the flight.
Timmons later told reporters that box cutters and even Al-Qaeda documents were found on the flight. Tom Manello recalls a slightly different story. He remembers being told by his chief pilot that box cutters were found on a sister aircraft at JFK, not his. The FBI interviewed them and it appears tried to track down the suspect passengers. Ultimately, Manello says he was told the FBI located them and decided that they weren't involved in the attacks. Now, 20 years later, Tom is still conflicted about what happened. For years afterward, he was confident the plane was supposed to be hijacked, that it was supposed to be the fifth plane of 9/11. But that conviction has faded. Maybe the nervous passengers in first class were just the first of countless, quote, Middle Eastern or Arab-looking men being unfairly profiled, something that unfortunately proliferated across the country after the attacks.
In my case, maybe this was a little bit of a self-defense mechanism, but I concluded that from what I'd seen and what I explained before, that the chances were this was simply just an ugly coincidence. I guess I still feel that this was just an ugly coincidence, but it's not by a whole lot. I'd say 51 to 49, it was a coincidence, but I'm still very unsure about the events that, of the day.
The idea of more planes being hijacked, of a fifth plane on 9/11, has existed in an awkward no man's land. Hard to prove and hard to disprove, though it has been largely dismissed by the various investigative bodies that have examined the day. The U.S. Air Force and the Air National Guard told Timmons' story around the 10th anniversary of the attacks. They hinted at the time that investigators had found Al-Qaeda materials in the luggage of the suspicious passengers. But neither the FBI nor the 9/11 Commission ever released any information about Flight 23. FBI Special Agent Jackie McGuire was the Bureau's lead investigator of the 9/11 attacks.
And it was, you know, an investigation that, again, looked at telephone analysis, financial analysis, any contact among the hijackers, between the hijackers, with co-conspirators overseas, the people who funded the attacks, the people who had concocted the plan for the operation. All of that has determined there were four flights involved in the attacks on 9/11, and just four flights.
As it was, by 10:03 a.m., the last hijacked plane crashed. The attacks were over. But it would take hours more to clear the U.S. airspace. The last flight, a U.S. Airways plane from Madrid, landed safely around 3 p.m. From the sky, Frank Culberson kept watching, floating far above in the International Space Station, passing over the U.S. every 90 minutes.
So every orbit, we kept trying to see more of what was happening. One of the most startling effects was that within about two orbits, all the contrails that are normally crisscrossing the United States had disappeared because they had grounded all the airplanes and there was nobody else flying in the U.S. airspace except for one airplane that was leaving a contrail from the central U.S. towards Washington, and that was Air Force One headed back to D.C. with President Bush.
Ben Sliney, who made that unprecedented decision to shut down the airspace, later left the FAA and has since retired. When he speaks publicly about September 11th, he reminds audiences of the bravery of what air traffic controllers did that day.
It was a horrible day for America, but for American aviation, I think it was a shining day. And I honestly don't think the aviation community got the thanks that they deserved from the American public.
Next time on Long Shadow, hear about FBI Special Agent John O'Neill, who was loudly ringing alarms on Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in the years before 9/11. As a result of warnings from his team and others inside the U.S. government, the FBI and CIA knew terrorists were planning a big attack in the summer of 2001. The CIA even had eyes on two of the eventual hijackers prior to September 11th. So what went wrong?
Your government failed you. Those entrusted with protecting you failed you. And I failed you.
Long Shadow is a production from Goat Rodeo and Longlead. You can find it wherever you get your podcasts. Go ahead and rate the show and leave us a review. It helps spread the word. I'm your host, Garrett Graff. Long Shadow's lead producer is Max Johnston. John Patrick Pullen is the show's executive producer. The episode was written by me and Max. Story editing from Morgan Springer. Editorial support from Dan Eisner, Diana Albasha, and Owen O'Carroll. Senior producers at Goat Rodeo are Megan Nadolsky and Ian Enright. Rebecca Seidel is managing producer. Music from Blue Dot Sessions and Ian Enright. Podcast artwork by Emily Crawford. Longlead's creative director is Natalie Matuszewski. And a thanks to ABC, CBS, NBC, PBS, C-SPAN, and the 9/11 Memorial and Museum for some of the archival audio you hear on the show.